The following Dharma talk was given at Boundless Way Temple in Worcester, Massachusetts. The temple is an affiliate of Boundless Way Zen, a multi-lineage school of Zen Buddhism.
So this is case 19 from the Gateless Gate collection. And the translation is a little different than the one we normally hear. It's by a Chinese-American teacher in the Chan, which is the Chinese word for Zen tradition. It's called Ordinary Mind is the Path. When Zhao Zhou asked Nanchuan, what is the way? Nanchuan said, the ordinary mind is the way. Zhao Zhou said, can one strive for it or not? Nanchuan said, when you strive for it, it recedes. Zhao Zhou said, if we don't try, how do we know it is the way? Nanchuan said, the way is not something known or not known. Knowing is false perception. Not knowing is just being oblivious. If you truly arrived on the way that is free from doubt, you would realize that it is vast, like open space, through and through. How is it possible to impose affirmation and denial? At these words, Zhao Zhou was suddenly awakened. So this is a very well-known case in the Gateless Gate collection, put together by Wu Men in the 13th century. In Boundless Way Zen, it's one of the texts that we work with when we're quite a ways along in our koan practice training. And it's very famous for a number of other reasons. The two characters involved in this, the teacher Nanchuan, who's a wonderful teacher from the Tang Dynasty in China, and his student Zhao Zhou, who at this point in Zhao Zhou's life, Zhao Zhou was a young student, eager to learn. And so he asks a series of questions, which I hope are relevant to you. Basically, what are we doing? What's going on here? How do we practice Zen? I don't get it. But of course, at this point, even though he's pretty young, he still is full of these questions, but also has had quite a lot of practice in sitting. Still, these questions arise for all of us, no matter how long we've been practicing, even if we're teachers. There's a certain amount of questioning that keeps our practice alive. If we don't have it, if we think that we know what practice is and we're all settled in to some kind of awareness of some limited knowledge about Zen, then we miss the mark. I'm just adjusting because my cushions are falling apart. And hopefully I'll be able to stay upright myself now. So when Zhao Zhou asks these questions with all this sincerity, he is beginning to speak for the generations of students who come after him. And I have to say that these questions maybe should be even more relevant than usual as we enter a world that is not so clear. We don't know what's going to happen in the future. We never know, of course, but I would say that some factors in the world right now have really accentuated that. Here we are at our very first hybrid sesshin with 12 of us in the Zendo and 24 people on screen on the Zoom Zendo, all of us practicing together. We've never done anything like this. Our sesshin in the past always used to be in person. We never thought we'd be on Zoom, and then lo and behold, on March 15th, 2020, we shifted to doing everything on Zoom. And as the pandemic has rippled up and down and up and down over the past really year, we've sometimes opened up the temple and sometimes closed it. And now here we are realizing that maybe our future is this. Planning future sesshins will be like this. And so we're getting used to doing it. It's amazing that we have a sangha that's so strong that we can have all these people. Some of you for the very first time sitting on the Zoom screen, some of you old hands, all of us, including me, floundering our way through trying to remember what happens next, even though we have some of this written down, it doesn't matter, getting it back into our bodies. And all of this is really designed so that when we practice the bells and the gongs and the clappers and the signals and the bowing, it all should at some point become second nature to us. We don't have to think about it anymore. But right now we're thinking about it. We're thinking about it in that wonderful way that I can't remember who it was. Some philosopher said that there are four stages we go through when we're learning anything. And this definitely applies to Zen and maybe even more to Sesshin. When we start out, we're unconsciously incompetent. We don't even know that we're doing something mistaken. And in the unconsciously incompetent stage, we need someone to gently, maybe sometimes strongly, point out that we need to learn some more about how to do this. And so then we get to the consciously incompetent stage, which is painful and necessary. When we're consciously incompetent, we recognize what we're doing. And it's very interesting to me that in that stage, which is so humbling and painful sometimes, it's where the real learning happens. Every time we make a so-called mistake of some kind, maybe we're late to practice or we're having trouble with our technology or we do things in an order that isn't the way we always do them, there's a great learning that happens. And then we become consciously competent. We know that we know what we're doing. It's kind of wonderful. We can say, I know how to practice Zen. And remember, this is only the third stage, because as this philosopher said, and as we also say in Zen, and as Nanchuan says to Zhaozhou, we need to become unconsciously competent. We need to not think about it so much. We need to not try to figure it out. At this stage in Zhaozhou's life, he's trying to figure everything out. And when he says, what is it? What is the way? Nanchuan quotes his own teacher, Matsu, a great teacher who had hundreds, maybe thousands of Dharma heirs. He was sometimes called Great Master Ma. And Great Master Ma said at one point when he was asked, what is Buddha? He said, it's your ordinary mind. And another time he said, no mind, no Buddha. And later when he was asked about that, he said, oh, I say ordinary mind when I'm talking to someone just starting out on the path. But then I say no mind, no Buddha when people think they know what I'm talking about. Kind of wonderful. So these questions have been asked for 1,000 years or more. What is the way? And Nanchuan says the ordinary mind is the way. And then Zhaozhou asks the question that should be on all of our minds. Should I strive for it? He's in the stage of being consciously incompetent. And he's trying to figure out, how do I learn this? How do I do it? And here's one of the core teachings of our path. Nanchuan says, when you strive for it, it recedes. In other words, if you chase after it, it just keeps getting farther and farther away because there's no it to strive after. Any image we have, anything we make up in our minds about what the future will be like, whether it's very, very hopeful or really, really negative, doesn't matter. It's all a creation of our minds, our ordinary minds, which do this all the time. We're always creating scenarios of the future. We even create scenarios of the past because we can only remember a few things that really happened. The 8 billion bits of information that come to us in every moment, of all of those, we can only perceive 8 of them, and we string them together in a story about what happened. in Zen practice, we can't stop this from happening. We can't stop making up things about the past, and we can't stop making up things about the future. But what we can see is that we are making things up. It's human nature, and it is how the ordinary mind functions. It's not some, there won't be a moment, I don't believe, I've never seen it, except in people who brag about it and then demonstrate that it's not true for them, that they are free of thoughts, free of thinking about the future, free of thinking about the past, free of judging the present moment. And of course, when they say I'm free of those things, there they are, judging the present moment with a certain kind of constructed thought, I am like this. These traps and snares come everywhere in Zen. It's kind of amazing that we value them. We don't think you need to get rid of them. We just think that you need to be consciously incompetent. You need to know. You need to know how your mind works. You need to know what the ordinary mind is that leads us to something that we call awakening, or as I prefer, realization, because we realize something. And then Jiaozhou, of course, rightly puzzled, he says, no, no, wait a minute, but I don't understand. If you don't try, then how can we know that we're on the right track? How can we know that we're on the way? And of course, we never know. One of the things that we say to people over and over again, but it doesn't really land, is that you can't judge your own practice. You may think you're doing really great, and hopefully you'll meet with a teacher who will gently or strongly tell you that you're full of shit. You may think that you're really doing terrible, you're the worst Zen person on the planet, and hopefully you'll meet with a teacher who says, either gently or strongly, you're full of shit. Because anything constructed in the mind isn't really what's going on. The ordinary mind is something to appreciate. Look at us thinking we're great or we're terrible. This is how it operates. Or look at us thinking that we're done with being human. We're just calm, serene, peaceful people floating maybe a quarter of an inch above the ground. All of it, deluded ideas about the way things are. And then Nanxuan gives this beautiful, teaching, really, that says everything we ever need to know. He says, the way is not something known or not known. Sometimes those of us who realize that we can't know everything, we really have an opening to not knowing, or as David's teacher's teacher used to say, Sung San, only don't know. We think we got it, check. Now another construction, another diluted construction takes over. Nanxuan says, that's not it either. It's not something you can know or not know, because knowing is false perception, as I've been describing. And not knowing is, I love this translation by Guo Go, just being oblivious, right? We think, oh, I'm so great, I don't know anything. And then we run into the wall. It's the way it is with human beings. There's no knowing or not knowing, not being stuck in yes or no, right or wrong, this or that, even though there is yes and no and right and wrong and this and that. Also, it's a way to get lost in a very particular way, holding on tightly to insights and into the letting go of insights. And then Nanxuan says, if you truly arrived on the way that is free from doubt, you would realize that it is vast, like open space through and through. This is one of the instructions we sometimes give. It's not really that we can be completely free from doubt, but there is a moment when the faith mind arises, the heart of true and trusting, as we say in one of our chants. This is entrusting the practice to the universe, which is vast, so vast that we can't ever get to the bottom of it. We can't get to the limits of it in any way. Nanxuan says here, it's vast like open space through and through. So how is it possible to impose affirmation and denial, to impose right and wrong, yes and no. All of that is the mind attempting to narrow the field, the vast field of open awareness, into some little tiny constructed narrative. So we do it about Zen, we do it about ourselves, we do it about the world. The reality is that everything is so vast and spacious, and also as tiny as a grain of sand, that we needn't get stuck in trying so hard to figure things out. Our ancestors gave us these simple instructions. Sit still, don't move. Be upright and present to everything coming and going. This is how we practice. And this is what Zhaozhou realized when he had his awakening. And Wu Men says in a comment right away later, just in case we think, oh, great, he went on then to become some wonderful teacher. Wu Men says Zhaozhou did awaken, but he still had to investigate for 30 more years. I might say for a lifetime. And now I'll hand the rest and the conclusion and the deepening of this talk over to David Roshi.
So ordinary mind is the way. Ordinary heart mind. What is this so-called ordinary way? Ordinary mind. In our school, and I think in the Zen tradition, there's a great respect for the ordinary. The mind likes to divide the world, and so we say there is ordinary, and then there is sacred. And we want to move from ordinary to sacred. But the teaching of Zen, and we might even say the suggestion of Zen, because none of these teachings are dogma. None of these teachings are to be accepted on face value. All of these teachings, all of these talks are to encourage you to step into your own life. The Dharma is not something that resides in the words of a teacher, no matter how ancient or revered. The Dharma, the truth of life, is your own life, is your encounter with this moment. And so the suggestion is that ordinary and sacred are just two words. As Melissa was saying, another philosopher, David Bohm, says the mind creates the world and then says, I didn't do it. Right? And we live in this world, and I think I want to not be here. I want to be in that wonderful Zen place. And I'm going to go on retreat and I'll really get Zen'd up. But of course, as we're on retreat, what do we encounter but aching knees and wandering mind? The romance wears off quite quickly. And what are we left with? What are you left with? This is the interesting question. So this valuing of the ordinary, valuing of the particular. On retreat online in the temple, we always have a samu, a caretaking practice. And in this ordinary life, this life of brushing our teeth and washing our face, this life of dealing with our families and friends, our bosses and employees, this very life, this very land is the lotus land, as Hakuin says in his lovely song of Zazen. This very place. And so when we come into contact with this moment, with the sound of the bird or the traffic, the sensations, even these thoughts that keep coursing through the mind, we're invited to look more closely. We're invited, as Melissa said, to notice, to become aware of what we don't know. You cannot enter the Dharma through your competence. You cannot enter the Dharma through your hard work. You are already in the Dharma. You are already walking the path. Where is the path? Where is the Tao? Just this question is exactly the moment, the longing that rises in the heart, the longing to realize for ourselves, the longing to close the gap between ourself and ourself. This longing itself is the manifestation of the way, the Tao, the source. It's said when the Buddha awakened to the suchness of things, to this perception of non-separation, he said, "Heaven above and earth below, I am the only one." This is not a proclamation of ego, but this is a realization, a perception that everything is intertwined, as we say, you and I, and the good things and the bad things and the wars and the great acts of heroism and sacrifice. All of this is who we are. All of this supports and sustains us. But this ordinary mind is not simply the chattering of everyday mind, the running commentary. But this running commentary, your judgments of yourself and your life, your judgments of others, your understandings, all are included in this. Our practice of Zen, we may think in the beginning, is getting rid of things. I'll get rid of this and I'll get rid of this and I won't be like this anymore, I'll be like that. But it doesn't work that way. Our practice of Zen is the practice of including more and more. One teacher said, everything you encounter, that difficult person, that impossible situation, the loss of those that we love, the betrayals, the shattering of our dreams, all of this is included. Not a single thing is left out. This ordinary mind has no edges. The vast Tao, the source world in each instant is revealing itself. Now as the taste of our breakfast as we eat. Now as the thoughts and emotions that course through the body, the sensations. Ordinary mind is the way. Yet, unless we cut through some kind of momentum of our life, the momentum of the ego, the momentum, we might say, of our karma, to see through. See through does not mean to change or evade or escape. Zen does not save us from our lives. Zen is not some kind of trick. In the end, we will lose everything we have. We will even lose ourselves. But this losing is... This losing is life itself. Gain and loss, fame and blame. Being good, being bad. Right in the middle of wherever you are. All of this effortless functioning, hearing happens, thinking happens, complaining happens, joy happens, sadness happens. We are awash in this vastness, this vast incomprehensible Dharma, this Tao that has no edges. And yet we meet this in the particular, we manifest as we bow one more time. And then we bow another time, and then we think we're done with our bows, and the bell rings again, and we bow again. This is the ordinary way. This is ordinary mind. When Zhaozhou asked Nanxuan, what is the way? Nanxuan said, the ordinary mind is the way. Zhaozhou said, can one strive for it or not? Nanxuan said, when you strive for it, it recedes. Zhaozhou said, if we don't try, how do we know it is the way? Nanxuan said, the way is not something known or not known. Knowing is false perception. Not knowing is just being oblivious. If you truly arrive on the way that is free from doubt, you would realize that it is vast like open space through and through. How is it possible to impose affirmation or denial? At these words, Zhaozhou was suddenly awakened. Thank you. Please sit comfortably. We'll move into our Dharma dialogue that I'm going to ask Melissa to, could you?
I will. So please, if you're in the Zoom Zendo, raise your Zoom hand if you'd like to say something. And if you're in this Zendo in the temple, raise your ordinary hand, demonstrating the ordinary way. And those of you in the Zoom Zendo will demonstrate the Zoom way, which is also your name. Yes, Anne.
Yeah, I can't resist. You say at one point
we can't hear muted. You.
And you seem to be muted.
I don't, no? Might not be you. Corwin, can you help with that?
Wait just a second.
Okay.
Try it again.
Nope.
No, we still can't.
Oh, now you're muted. You're actually there. Try it again.
Okay.
Yeah. Oh! Thank you, Anne.
That's all we need. Thank you.
It's always good to be the first. So you say we are awash in the Dharma, but right before you said that, we did a sutra which said that Dharma is rarely encountered, even hundreds of thousands of years. Yeah. Don't these two contradict each other?
Oh, and I should say that Alan will also be helping us answer questions. He's nodding and smiling right now, so he may have an answer for you.
I'm nodding and smiling because years ago I asked the same question.
And, what know, was the answer?
Yeah.
I can't remember what James for me, unfortunately, so I'll have to give you my answer, which is yes. You know, these are two completely different ways of coming at the same thing. On the one hand, you know, we're so fortunate to have encountered the Dharma. I mean, we're fortunate to have been born at all, you know, given all the chances against it. And then to have been born in a time and place when we can encounter the Dharma is amazing. And this chant has been used for centuries and centuries to remind us of the fact that we're fortunate to hear Dharma talks, to have koans, to have this tradition. And at the same time, what this tradition gives us is something that we've been steeping in all our lives, but not able maybe to see as it is. This is the ordinary mind that the koan speaks of. It's not something extraordinary that the Buddha fetched out of outer space and delivered to the chosen few. It's something that the Buddha amazingly was able to notice about just how life already was. And yet we let all kinds of obstructions get in the way of that. So it's really both.
Thank you. Yes, Will. Will,
I just want to say that answer pisses me off. Why did it have to be so hard to see? You know, it's like somebody set this up wrong. So I don't know. I just want to give.
Well, it's great to object to it.
Yeah.
That's the ordinary mind coming up as objection. I mean, hello.
Yeah.
Like, this doesn't make any sense.
Yeah. You know,
what Alan said made perfect sense to me.
I understand it, but it's unfair.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, and this is the point of view that we've been raised in Western culture, where there's some creator entity that we can blame for giving us life and giving us, you know, the setup. And I'm not sure that's true. There's some way that we have to get to, and you're nodding if you can't see them, to see that this is how it is. You know, I read a lot of science fiction, and sometimes I look at human beings and I think, why do we have heads on necks and ears here and nostrils? And it doesn't, I don't, why, when it could be otherwise, you know, but no, it actually couldn't be otherwise. This is the way it is. This is what human beings are like. And this is what the Dharma is like. We're surrounded by it. You know, it's the joke. Let me see if I can get it right. I'm so bad at jokes. Or am I? Affirmation and negation. I don't know. But you know, of the old fish that's in the ocean, and two little young fish come along, and the old fish says, "You don't see the water that you're swimming in," you know. And then they go off, the little fish, and they say, "Water? What's this water he's talking about?" So we don't see the Dharma. We really don't. It's invisible to us. Even hearing the teaching, ordinary mind is the way, it's a little bit of a misdirect. And Guogu actually talks about it in his Taisho on this, that it sounds like it's free license to just be ordinary. But that's not what we're saying either, because we have to, it's that we can't remain unconsciously incompetent. Well, I guess we can for our whole lives. But to see that this mind, this thing we want to get away from, or that we don't like, or is the Dharma. We need somebody to point that out. And so you could say that Buddhism is
pointing out, Zen especially is pointing out the water. And then one day we go, oh, I'm swimming in water. It's quite an amazing moment. That's what we call realization.
Can I just, so it you means can. The pain, the difficulty, the suffering is necessary because it's given.
It appears to be, yeah.
And this was the Buddha's first great realization. Yeah. That the pain, that difficulty is a noble truth. It's also a pesky truth, and you know, we can rail against it. And I think appropriate, like I love the Psalms where the prophets say, you know, God, I can't believe you let it get like this. And we can, you know, object to the universe. How come me? Why me? But there is this possibility of, oh, it's just this way. And this is the entry point, mm-hmm. right? Without suffering, we don't wake up, mm-hmm. right? Suffering is not a design defect, but it's a feature, not a bug.
It's a feature, not a bug.
Yeah. And how wonderful we can get caught in the Zen trap of nodding our head and pretending it's okay. And sometimes it's not okay. Yeah. And it just pisses us off. Yeah. So appreciate you bringing that energy.
Thank you very much. Yeah. And with such goodwill. Pierce?
Can you hear me?
Yes. And led the way. And now we can hear you.
Great. Thanks both of you for the tissue. And this really, this koan really hits me where I live. I often ask this question, can I enter the way by striving? And even though I have some idea that this is not the way, my body keeps trying to do it this way. And it's very disappointing to me to hear, as David put it, that you cannot enter the way by means of your competence. You cannot enter the way by means of your hard work. Because I give myself credit for those qualities. Sure. I find they're not going to be useful to me in this. Very disappointing. And also this business of knowing, you know, I had a conversation with Melissa last week, and I came away remembering that there was a moment in the conversation when, as I put it to myself afterwards, I seemed to realize that Zen is not like anything else that I do. Hmm. And my reaction to that was, the next time I talk to Melissa, I'm going to pin her down and get her to explain to me exactly how Zen differs from everything else. Yeah. And then I'll know how to do it. but this koan, when the answer is given that knowing is false perception and not knowing is just being oblivious. Yeah. So the gist of it is that I can't explain it to myself. And at this moment, that seems like a very valuable insight. So thank you very much.
Yes, sometimes we think insight is when we can explain it to ourselves. And so we're really trying to investigate. But I love this possibility that it is unexplainable. And the pursuit of the explanation is not the practice of Zen, right? There's something else that's more interesting and weirder and more troubling and more joyous beyond all of that. Thanks, Pierce.
Jenny.
When you were talking about the four phases, which I've never heard that before, and it makes a lot of sense. But I interjected one between conscious competence and unconscious competence, which is complacency, which I kind of expect of myself. And I realized that I have this belief that complacency comes next and falling down. And then I interject challenges to try to like fool complacency, I guess. And then that's not trusting. That's not resting on the river. Yeah. So.
Yeah, how beautiful, you. Really. I love that. You know, the, anytime you hear anybody give you a schema, you need to be a little suspicious. Things just don't go like that. But we can identify with them as you could. And I think that complacency is a very natural human trait. And it's another strategy, right? It's a strategy. It's like, I've reached it. And now I can just stop practicing. Mm-hmm. Now I'm done. You know, and some people will hear this koan. Oh, ordinary mind is the way. What am I doing at a sesshin, getting up early in the morning and sitting all day? That's ridiculous. But it isn't, because this is it's like a balm for complacency. It's medicine for complacency. That's one of the reasons I love to do sesshin, because no matter what you think going into it, you will be surprised. Really, I guarantee it. It's never what we think it's going to be. And life isn't like that. The inconvenient truths of suffering.
And the wonderful thing about this four-step schema, and even about complacency, is, you know, ultimately you don't have to worry about complacency, because life will come get you. Right? and I think in our practice, even though there are no stages, there are places where it opens up and where there's a kind of a comfort that we can feel sometimes in this moment and this approach, and then that too breaks apart. So it's not like there isn't growth and insight. It's just that wherever you are, then that breaks apart, and you get to be. At the same time, you're consciously competent, you're also unconsciously incompetent in whatever's next.
Yeah. And complacency, as you're saying that, I'm thinking about those of you on the Zoom screen didn't get to see this wonderful thing that happened this morning, which was that we do a little ritual that I was supposed to be in charge of, where there's step A, step B, and step C. And I did it in the order of step C, and then I realized that was wrong. And then I went back to A, and then I went back to B. But I was complacent, which is a way of saying I was unconsciously incompetent again. And then I became consciously competent. I knew it was wrong. It was so clear. And then, you know, it's sort of like a cycle, even with everything. We can think we get it. You know, I know how to drive a car. And then suddenly we have an electric car, and we can't figure out how to plug in the nozzle. There's just this constant shifting, and so it's so infuriating, as Will was saying, and it's also so great. You know, if we didn't get to that, we would just become stuck in the mire somehow. Thank you, Jenny. Bix.
Hi. I have a few things to say. First off, that piece of insight that Pierce shared was part of it resonated with me a lot, because I feel like there's so many times where I have some sort of insight and a smile appears on my face ear to ear, and I have no idea what it is. Like I know, you know, some idea pops into my head and I have a huge smile on my face, but I can't put it into words. It's just, and you know, and then that's sometimes frustrating, and that, you know, fills me with confusion and so on. Secondly, something that David said also really resonated with me, which is that we do our vows, and then we think we're done with our vows, and then the bell rings again, and we. So that resonated with me a lot. I've had a lot of times in my life where, you know, I'll go through like a rough period, and then I'll come out of that rough period and I'm like, oh, I'm so happy. I'm done with that. And then it passes, and yeah. And the last thing that I wanted to, I have a question. I feel like striving is inevitable. I feel like we need to do some amount of striving, because I wake up every morning and I do my practice, is that not striving in some capacity?
Alan.
We keep giving Alan the hard questions.
So waking up each morning and doing your practice is great. It's wonderful. And then the question would be, do you have to strive while you do it? Is there a way to do it as though, like, I'm guessing that when you brush your teeth in the morning, you don't have to force yourself to do it. You're not saying, Vince, brush your teeth. You have to do it. You just do it because that's what's right. It's morning. It's time to brush your teeth. So what if your practice can be just like that? Can be something that you just do because it's what wants to be done at that moment. That's where I would direct you. I just want to say, I love that when you said that you'll have an insight and you won't be able to put it into words, and then you let that go, you know? So that's great. Keep doing that. That's doing it without striving, not needing the words, just letting it be that feeling and being content with that.
Yeah. And also in this doing your best, sometimes so this is about how do we make effort in practice, right? Clearly it requires something. And part of it is learning what kind of effort that is. And one teacher at one point says you should practice as if your hair was on fire, like this urgency. We say, you know, give yourself to it. Don't slack off. It's important. We don't know. And then there's also this, the effort of a falling leaf. Leaf doesn't say, I've got to get to the ground. I've got to get to the ground. Not a fixed position here does require great effort and intention to keep walking this path, to keep doing it, and not a problem.
And this is very similar to Anne's question that Alan answered about, you know, is it this or is it this? Is it everywhere or is it rarely encountered? It relates to the koan again, ordinary mind is the way. So it's ordinary to strive. People do it all the time. I actually have to force myself to brush my teeth. So I was thinking of a different analogy. Like I have to go to the bathroom when I get up. So I'm not thinking, I better get myself out of bed and get to the bathroom. I just don't think, I just go. Thank goodness. For now, that's what's happening. aging is but this if you try to not strive, then you're actually making things worse because you put all this energy. I'm not going to strive, you know, and it's like those little woven bamboo puzzles that you put around your fingers and you put your fingers in and then keep trying to pull out to get out. But really the way you get out of them is you put your fingers together. There's some way in this practice that you say, look at me, I'm striving. This is striving. And you taste it and you become very intimate with it. And then it changes into something else on your own. You don't even have to stop striving. It's you just have to be awake to it. You know, what is it? Awareness is its own action. It's a very powerful teaching. Thanks. Thank you. Let's go to Corwin. We have more people on screen.
Thank you. Thank you both for the talk and everyone for the dialogue. It's been great. And a lot of stuff going through my mind, but when you were talking about the four steps of competence, I kept going back and bucketizing my entire morning and starting with last night of all the times I was consciously and unconsciously incompetent. And just like categorizing everything into of my activity into those two things and thinking how hard I'm trying to be consciously competent. And there's always something I forget. And yet this session's still going on. Like it's all okay. And it's probably not as bad as I think. And then it also occurred to me, kind of like what Jenny did, she added an extra one. There's also one, I don't know exactly where it goes, but there's the consciously impotent. Like I wanted to reach into the Zendo and change the Moki Go to the smaller one, or get, I think it's Paul who was playing it, get him to hit it a little softer, but there was nothing I could do. And I'm like, you know what?
Well, it's hard for those of us in the Zendo with Paul.
But anyway, I was counting my blessings that I didn't have to deal with him in person, but no, but
back to your analogy.
But yeah, just,
yeah,
you know, just, there's so many things that we can't control that are obvious that we can't control, but there's so many things that we try to do that, again, we can't really do those either. And so it sometimes just helps to remember, even though we're gonna mess up, you know, shit happens and life goes on. This session's still going. Zoom hasn't blown up yet. And yeah, I can always switch the camera a little bit later.
So, yeah. Well, and that the point, again, going back to what Pierce said, is not about competence. So incompetent, conscious, unconscious, competent, that it all goes on, it all flows on. And seeing this, as Melissa was just quoting, seeing this is enough. We call this being human. Thanks.
Susan Lamar.
I'm wondering about a whole different definition of striving. You know, when the first question last night, you know, the series of questions, why are you here? Why are you here? Why are you here? You know, my first answer was, I don't know. And then basically I have absolutely no idea. And the second answer was, my feet carried me to my set up spot. And then and then I just started to cry on the third answer. I had no idea what that was about. And then when we got out at 8:30 last night, I don't know what it was like outside other people's houses, but I walked up the stairs and the air was the most beautiful rosy color from the sunset. And all I could think was, well, what's making the air so beautifully rosy? And I went out and I just appreciated that. And how does that, I mean, I wasn't striving, but man, what a reward. And then right after this talk, I knew there was a robin's nest under my deck, and I'm on the lower level. And after your talk, just now, I looked up and I have the most perfect view of this robin sitting on her eggs. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking, well, is she striving? Is she consciously incompetent or incompetent? You know? And then I'm looking, I wonder if she's looking back at me. So all through this, I've been listening to everybody else. There's just been this wonderful striving, not striving thing going on. And a moment ago she flew away. So I guess she's resting. She's in her between period. but it's just, I'm thinking, you know, the striving was simply the showing up. And sometimes that's enough. And, you know, God knows my whole life I've been, you have to be competent, you have to achieve, you have to obtain.
Yes, right.
To be letting go of that and just say, well, wow, the air is rosy and the robins are laying their eggs and I'm just sitting here and all these other people all over the world are just sitting here. It's a miracle and we're together.
It is.
That's it.
And, you know, there's a certain amount, striving is a funny word. It carries a kind of pejorative meaning, right? It sounds negative. Mm-hmm. But there's also something about giving your body and soul to something, mm-hmm. you know, and tonight we will hear from a hungry ghost mm-hmm. who is going to warn us. We haven't been doing this during our Zoom sessions, I don't think.
Yeah, we have.
Oh, we have. Yeah. So some of you have heard this before. When the hungry ghost tells us, you know, what he says.
Don't squander your life.
Don't squander your life. Take heed. Don't squander your life. Mm-hmm.
that's a kind of energetic push, you know, to really show up in a certain way and pay attention. But at a certain point, the showing up and paying attention does become less angsty. But I think there is a period of our life when it has to be kind of angsty. Because again, you know, come on, we're still in the middle of a pandemic and war and racial injustice and violence and all this stuff is going on. And, you know, like I love Corwin's comment about he just wants to reach through the Zoom screen and do something about it, right? And that's a kind of striving that we can have in us, but ultimately we realize we can't do anything with it, like the little finger puzzle. We tug and we tug and we tug. Who's to say that that wish and the tugging isn't also useful? The Buddha, he went through all the stuff before he woke up under the Bodhi tree and saw the morning star, you know, just like he saw the sky last night, right? It's just, but he saw it, nothing in the way. So it's both, I would call it, you know, striving has such a negative connotation. Maybe another word is full energetic commitment to the way. Sit up straight. Don't move. What do you think? What are you doing scratching your head? Put your hand down. You know, we need to, this is a discipline. It's a discipline. And it takes some energy to do it. Otherwise, we'll just sit around and, you know, play with our phones and play on the computer until 3 a.m. I mean, we do this because we lose our mojo. So this Zen actually wants you to develop a mojo, the fire in your hair. It's part of it. And it's weird. And you know, along the lines of this whole conversation, we can't really figure it out. Mm-hmm. We can't say, I get it now. I know how to be energetically strong without striving. Good luck.
But and I think of wholehearted as, you know, and I love both of these together. This wholehearted requires this, you know, really do it. And then also, you just have to show up. Right? You just have to open the door. You just have to sit down on the cushion. And part of Sesshin is all you have to do is keep coming back, you know, again and again, and give yourself to what you love. Yeah.
Thanks, Susan. Thanks. Anybody else in the Zendo? Nope. So let's have Chad be our last. Chad Cook.
Thank you for the talk, and everybody's comments were really resonating in different ways for me. But what struck me interestingly in how I was thinking about it is that in conjunction with this striving thing that I always do, and I've been brought up that way and other things, it's like this little collaborator of clinging. Like what I found is I'm really, I think, seeking that feeling. So it's the striving towards the good feeling. And I like that aspect of having my hair on fire. Obviously it's hot, yeah. Right? And how I throw myself wholeheartedly into, I think, striving and trying to find that feeling, whether it's good, but then also on the other side of it, when I feel like I've failed or I've done something not as well as I want to, I'm wholeheartedly clinging to that feeling of terribleness, right? Mm-hmm. And so this is like this always a struggle for me in trying to think about that and then be aware of it, but then it just sort of moves on like everything else does, but I don't think I can appreciate that all the time.
Yeah, I love the both sides of that, really seeing both the habituated striving. Like if I'm not doing that, then I feel like something's wrong. So we're just used to that. And then this clinging too, you know, I'm so incompetent or I failed or I should have been different. And I love what you're pointing to of it all comes and it goes. We cannot change it through force of our will. Right. So this is not like, you know, as Melissa said, striving not to strive or clinging to not clinging, all kinds of ways. But just to be aware, to show up and give ourselves again and again, such a rare privilege.
Paul, did you have your hand up? No, okay. So I'll just say one more quick thing then, and then we'll come back to our seated posture. This clinging to the things we've done wrong, it's part of our nature that developed a long time ago as a useful thing. There was a benevolent intention. Make sure you cling to that so that you'll remember not to do it that way again. And then it just becomes this habit, and it changes into the narrative of the self, which is, I'm just such a sorry person and a loser. And to not, again, not to let go of the letting go, but to feel the clutch of the hand on those old personality patterns, and how the hand is almost paralyzed in its grip. And it hurts to open the hand of thought. It does hurt. And then things will start to leave on their own. You don't have to let them go or get rid of them. But again, this theme of, here it is, what is it? Can I be here for this? And I think you just demonstrated that you can by describing. So let's all come back to our sitting posture.